There are, over the course of 2.5 days, 6 sessions where we will sit together in one room as a large group. And you've already sat through number one. Derek wonderfully laid out what has to be done. We often like to say, so you want to be a Bible teacher? So you want to be a preacher? What has to be done? And that rectangle demonstrates the what. In fact, the little fun exercises we had along the way solidify the challenge of actually doing it. You got to go from text to today. And that journey is done every week or every time you've got to teach the Bible. But that journey is challenging. And so the next 5 sessions in large group are really built to serve your work in small groups. The large groups serve the small groups by putting forward the hows. How do I go about doing this to be both faithful and fruitful? And for that, I'm going to start a talk on argument. And I'm going to do so by quoting from St. Augustine. He's got a little work, if you haven't read it, called On Christian Doctrine. Book 4, I'm taking my cue. Quote, "There are 2 things upon which all interpretation of Scripture depends. The process of discovering what we need to learn and the process of presenting what we have learnt." And the translation I've got, it's L-E-A-R-N-T, learnt. So I love that because I was a 1.9 GPA and it's nice to know that Augustine wasn't that smart either. Or whoever translated him. Let's get that line right and let's put it into the last talk. The process of discovering what we need to learn and then the process of presenting what we have learned. If you isolate it, really, he's saying there's something about the text you need to know, yet in presentation, you've got to present it in ways that matter today. And so if you're the preacher or the Bible teacher, those are the 2 directions you move every week. Those are the 2 directions. In the session before, you've got this straight line from text to today. And all I'm trying to say is Augustine actually realized a long time ago that those are the 2 things that are required for good interpretation for the health of the church. From text to today, you've got to get it right. But you're not going to be worth your weight in salt in ministry if you can't get it across. So in one sense then, on the how-tos, I want to talk about argument. If you have text and you've got to get it today, I wonder if you could tell the guy next to you, which leg of that journey do you think argument would fall? Go for it. All right, what do you got? Argument, which leg of the journey? You need some context. What are you saying?
I'm saying there's an argument that the author's making to the original audience, and then there's my argument to my audience that is what you would say.
Beautiful. So you've actually problematized my question. Argument is the author to them and then. But argument is the preacher and to the people that you're speaking. Now, when you think about working through your small groups this week, you're going to see that word appear twice, argument. What is the argument the author is making to his readers? That's one of the things that keeps us on the rails of fidelity when we start thinking about what is the argument you're going to make to your audience. So there's probably going to be some overlapping in how these 2 things can work together. For the next 55 minutes, though, I want to center simply on the one that sits over here. It might sound a little backwards because we're already out of sequence. How do I go about text today? The first how-to is going to say, let's put your sermon at the forefront of your mind. Everything we do is moving to the sermon. So let's talk about argument on this leg of the journey, the presentation side, according to Augustine. And for that, I'm going to draw you a picture. It's one of my favorites. All right, that hangs in the Museum of Modern Art. You'll have to tell the guy next to you what that is. Tell the guy next to you, what is that? Helm's Maniacal Drawings? Be careful now. What do you got? Anybody? What is it? What is it? Fat lady bending over garbage can, yeah. Now, why do you say it's a lady? Man, that is pejorative sexist comment. Let me tell you what it is. Let me tell you what it is. That's Rodin's The Thinker. I'll be levering. Before you mock me, just how many of your drawings are actually published? Hey, man. That's the Dave Helm original. Rodin's The Thinker. You might go, I don't even know what that is. It's a bronze sculpture. It's in Paris. There's a man on a rock, one hand on his chin. And he's deep in thought. That's the app on my iPhone for the how-to on argument. That's what it stands for. The work, The Thinker by Rodin, was actually based on Dante's Divine Comedy. Some of you might be aware of that if you were English lit majors. It was commissioned for the doorway surround at the gates of hell. So that's what Rodin made this. And there's some debate in regard to who is the thinker. Does it refer to the guide in the book who takes the person through and posits them through argument at the gate of hell? Or is it the one who was taken through, the listener, not the preacher, who now is left at the gates of hell and contemplating the argument that's been made? You're tracking with me a little bit now. The thinker has a picture, but the principle is simply this. The principle is that every preacher becomes like Rodin's The Thinker at some moment in his preparation. He has to fashion his message. Remember, I'm talking about this part of the argument today. You're now doing sermon writing. He has to fashion his message in a way that is best suited to convince his listener. And to do that, you got to make an argument. Every talk you give is making an argument of sorts to the listener concerning what you think the text would have them consider. You'll either make a good one, a bad one, a strong one, a weak one, a pervasive one, or a persuasive one, or one that's not. That's the picture, that's the principle. What's the relationship to preaching? In a nutshell, we all make an argument because preaching by nature is persuasion. Preaching is persuasion. I got a proof text. Somebody turn up. We could all follow you there. Acts 26, 24 to 29. Acts 26, I think, 24 to 29. Can somebody just start that off, read that to us nice and loud? This is my proof text that all preaching is persuasion.
And as he was saying these things in his defense, Festus said with a loud voice, "Paul, you are out of your mind. Your great learning is driving you out of your mind." But Paul said, "I'm not out of my mind, most excellent Festus, but I am speaking true and rational words, for the king knows about these things, and to him I speak boldly. For I am persuaded that none of these things has escaped his notice, for this has not been done in a corner. King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know that you believe." And Agrippa said to Paul, "In a short time would you persuade me to be a Christian?" And Paul said, "Whether short or long, I would do to God that not only you, but also all who hear me this day might become such as I am, except for these chains.
Great little dialogue. Here he is talking to somebody from the scriptures, and this whole language about I'm persuaded, and then would you persuade me? And he says, yes, that is my object. My object is to persuade you, whether it would take me a long time or a short time, whether this is a 20-minute talk or a one-hour talk. It matters not to me the length of the argument. The argument will need to be as long as it is required to hopefully persuade one to become a Christian. Do you ever think of your ministry that way when you get to sermon writing? When you get to sermon writing, you are now out to persuade, which is a little different than simply thinking that that the idea of your sermon is what's the big idea of my text. As long as that's all you're thinking about when you're writing the sermon, you, the preacher, are still in thought facing text. But sermon writing, making the argument, your mind is now facing today. Totally different thing. So let's talk about this. Cicero called it, then, how do you be successful? He said there's three things that you need to be successful in oratory. Three things that your arguments are going to require: to instruct, to delight, to move. And by move, in other words, your sermons, you're teaching something, you're instructing them, you're delighting something, not entertaining. He didn't mean entertainment. He meant it should be pleasing. And then third, to move doesn't mean emotionally move you, which is what we're always trying to do in the pulpit. Move for him actually meant conquest. He wanted to conquer the mind. In fact, Augustine borrowed Cicero's three words, instruct, delight, and move, and he put it to you this way: to learn, to please, and here it is, to bring to obedience. How often do you think about that when you're sermon writing? My sermon writing, my presentation has to bring people to obedience. Dabney put it, to produce a practical determination of the will. Now, there's a lot of times I don't use Dabney anymore because he got so many things wrong in ways that have been hurtful in our country. But on that line, he's pretty good. The purpose of your preaching sermon is to produce a practical determination of the will. So that's the goal in presentation, guys. That's the goal in making your argument. Let me now define the argument as closely as I can. This is my definition of argument. An argument is the one thing you are dead set on convincing your listener of in this sermon and the considerations that prove it. I took a while. Let me say it again. An argument is the one thing you are dead set on convincing your listener of in this sermon and the considerations that prove it. In other words, then, the argument is taking place from the very first word you speak to the last word you say. From when you stand up to when you sit down, your sermon is an argument. You're trying to persuade them of the one thing and the considerations that prove it. To put it differently, that's the one thing you're out to persuade them of from your presentation and the points that prove it. Wow, this could be the takeaway of the week for some of us. Because some guys, we've been doing this one in Des Moines for a while. So we got guys here that are convinced that the exegetical process is important. The historical grammatical approach, I build that in. We've, got a sense of theological reflection and trying to organically, authentically move to Christ. That's important, and I try to make sure that I do that well. But when you actually get to this leg down over here, presentation side, we're still not as strong as we might want to be. And it might help you this year more than anything else to go home with every sermon I preach, I better be able to state by Friday the one thing I'm out to persuade my listener of and the points that prove it. And if I can't state that, I'm not ready to preach. I'm going to get up and talk about the text. I'm going to talk about the big idea of this. I'm going to talk about the logic of this. I'm going to be facing that, but I'm not yet facing my people to convince them. Or you might say, you do instruction well, you do delight well, but you don't move in the sense of conquering wills, bringing to obedience, practical determination of the mind as a consequence of your preaching. Three qualities are necessary then. Three qualities. Three qualities are necessary. According to Cicero, we'll see if we got any ancient Greek rhetoricians around here. Your table, one table, three qualities that Cicero says, if you want to do that well, you better have these three things in your pocket. What are they? Tell your table. What are they? All right, anything in the back left, far back left? You got one of the three? All right, give us one. That is a correct thing, but that's not one of Cicero's three on this point. But I would say with you, if you don't have ethos, if you don't have that indispensable characteristic of integrity, you're not going to persuade anybody. So yes, that's going to be in the panoply of things. But let's get to the three that he says successful oratory demands. Somebody give me one. What'd you come up on this table? To instruct? Well, we already had that in regard to what it was doing. Nobody. Isn't it fun? I'm glad to know I'm not the only athlete in the room.
We got brevity, clarity, plausibility.
There they are. Brevity, clarity, plausibility. These are words he used, and it'll be helpful to you. What did he mean by brevity? So if you're in your presentation, when you're actually writing your sermon, brevity is important. Now let's understand what he meant by brevity.
Think of precision.
This is what he says. If we carry our argument forward, not to the furthermost point, but to the point to which we need to go, that's brevity. If we use no digressions and do not wander from the account we have undertaken to set forth, that's brevity. Now, I love that, because what that means is you and I go home, and the next 52 weeks, every time you find yourself right here in your sermon and you say, you know, I just want to give you an aside here, guess what you're doing? You've probably stepped outside your argument. You're doing digression. You're moving your people away from the one thing you wanted because there was another thing or two or three or four or worse yet in front of the Bible. Now it's me and you, all of this kind of stuff. You do all of that, you're actually moving away from the argument. Brevity, according to Cicero, really required confining yourself in your presentation, not to say comprehensively everything that could be said from here, not to the furthermost, but to the point I needed to go. Quintilian put it this way: our definition of brevity, however, is not saying less than one ought to say, but not saying more. Not saying more. I mean, this might help your sermon for the rest of the year too. You might go from an hour or saying, we hired a guy one time and he did his first sermon, and he was a seasoned guy, dear friend of mine still to this day, and lives in Kansas City and goes by the name of, no, I won't go that far. So, and he got done, and I said, that was good, but, you know, I said, do you know how long you were? He goes, I was probably 45 minutes. I said, yeah, you were 45 minutes. I said, I kind of felt like it was all good, but I felt like it would have been stronger at 35 minutes. And his word to me was, oh, Dave, I got a 45-minute package. I said, you got a what? I got a 45-minute package. Well, not every sermon requires the same amount of time to make the argument that is required. But your preaching, your presentation should not be longer or shorter than what's needed for the argument to be made. So how long do you preach is not so much an important thing to me as how long does it take from this text, that argument, to persuasively be put forward to my people. Let's look at clarity. What do they mean by clarity? Quintilian. A narrative will be clear and lucid first if it is set out in normal but expressive words. Your presentation has got a better chance of persuading someone if you set it out in normal but expressive words. Now, this is actually something that you probably need to work on a little bit this week in your small groups, because you're going to have guys showing the structure of the text over here, and that structure is going to be put forward normally in textual terms, in probably exegetical terms sometimes, in theological terms. But by the time you actually get over here, there probably should be some kind of transference rather than just duplication of. Not always, but normal. What about plausibility? Well, it's kind of self-explanatory, but Quintilian would say, if we do not say anything contrary to what is natural, they're talking about affectation. I mean, you can undermine your sermon by not actually being yourself. You know, you undermined your argument. You were considered, back to ethos at the table, this is where it would probably fall most likely. You can undermine your argument if you're not actually deemed to be credible before the people. And so if you've got a whole preacher's voice that's different than something else, or if you're not fully you, then you actually undermine things. And the argument itself, it should be reasonable. What you say should be reasonable, not just emotional. That's what Paul did, right? He reasoned with him. So those are the three characteristics that are required for strong argument. Let's do some work. Let's summarize a bit of what we've said to this point and put you in some texts. We're going to be in Hebrews this week, and we're still warming up to it. But I'm going to then suppose that Hebrews, from the first word to the last line, is making an argument. It's discourse. We're in discourse this week. Discourse, by nature, follows the logic. It's speech. Somebody is speaking, and he has something he's trying to persuade his listener of. From the very first word in Hebrews to the last, we should expect to find an argument being made. We should expect to find the one thing he's out to persuade them of and the various manifested arguments or proofs related to it that he thinks are important in bringing to them. And Derek's already had you there. I mean, let's just take a look. Look at Hebrews 1, 1 to 3. We're going to come back to this in a minute. But and we're serving right now. Our first two talks are hoping to serve your first small group session, not replace the interaction with the person's presentation on this. But there it is. Long ago, at many times in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets, but in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son. It'll be fun for you to work out in your small group the significance of that clause, that major clause, that out-of-the-gate line. He spoke in many ways, but God has now spoken to us by his Son. There's something instrumental there in regard to his persuasive aim. What's fascinating is if you look back at Hebrews 13, just turn up 13:22, which is the end of the letter. As we try to, one of our goals this week is that you'll come out of here with a much better understanding of Hebrews and hopefully a desire to preach it in the coming year, perhaps even. But look at verse 22. This is fascinating. I appeal to you, brothers, bear with my word of exhortation, for I have written to you briefly. He summarizes his entire book through the word exhortation, which is fascinating, and you'll work this out in your small groups. It's a speech. In fact, if you read Hebrews right through out loud, it'd probably take you about 45 minutes. It's probably about a 45-minute sermon. It's an exhortation. So my guess is that the book then as a whole has one thing in particular that is the dominant persuasive point he's trying to make. To put it differently, you could put Hebrews like this. If Hebrews sits between these things, all of Hebrews functions down to what something we would try to understand as his major argument and aim. There is an argument being made, and it moves like that, the whole book. Now, what does that mean for you as a preacher? And this is where we're going to put you in different texts. If that's true for the whole book, then the whole book actually works like this. Well, that's not a Halloween thing. Sorry. The whole book has a series of many arguments that are made. These are literary, rational pericopes of thought that each serve the writer's purpose and persuasive aim. So the book actually then will develop the overall argument by putting forward the proofs that actually indicate it. So an argument is not only what am I trying to say to my audience, but the considerations that prove it. So every week, you should be actually thinking about what argument is being made here to his listener, but how is it developing in regard to the argument I need to make in my preaching? Yeah, so let me take it to one text. We're all the way down to one text. Let's say you're going to preach this week from Hebrews 7. 11 to 19. Everybody turn there. Let's say that this was the text that you were to preach this coming week. It's Monday morning. You came to a preaching workshop at this church in Des Moines. And the guy told you that an argument visually kind of looks like this, that there's a text. Certainly there's lots of texts on either side of this, but my text this week is that one. So I just draw this. This is what I might do on a Monday morning. Here's my preaching text. I need to see what the argument is that's being made so that I can actually understand the persuasive aim. It's going to require me to do text work. What's the argument that the writer made before I begin to think about the argument that I make? But let's just take this text for a moment. Let's say, and I'll give you a head start, let's say that Monday and Tuesday's work has already been done. Hebrews 7, 11 to 19. Let's say that I'm doing the structure work that you're going to do in small groups. I'm trying to think of how is this text organized? What is going on in this text? Let's take a look. Somebody read it out loud for us, 11 through 19. We're going to spend 20 minutes in this text together. 11 through 19, somebody go for it.
Now, if perfection was through the Levitical priesthood, or on the basis of it, the people received the law, what further need was there for another priest to arise according to the order of Melchizedek and not be designated according to Aaron? For when the priesthood is changed of necessity, there takes place a change of law also. For the one concerning whom these things are spoken belongs to another tribe, from which no one has officiated at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord was descended from Judah, a tribe with reference to which Moses spoke nothing. And this is clearer still if another priest arises according to the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become such not on the basis of a law of physical requirement, but
but according to the power of an indestructible life. For it is attested of him, you are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. For on the one hand, there is a setting aside of a former commandment because of its weakness and uselessness, for the law made nothing perfect. And on the other hand, there is a bringing in of a better hope through which we draw near to God.
This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. And your people are clueless about what the pastor is supposed to persuade me of from here. Fortunately, you knocked your head against this text for about 10 hours by Tuesday dinner time. And by that time, when you thought about the text itself and not today, you had made some observations. Observation number one, in verse 11, there is this word perfection. If perfection had been attainable through Levitical priesthood, perfection in relationship to the Levitical priesthood. Somewhere in Monday and Tuesday, you had made a similar observation on the verse 19, the way the whole thing closed. And you saw again that there was perfect here, this idea of perfection, not at this point stated in terms of the Levitical priesthood, but in terms of the law itself. You didn't know what to do with it yet, but you were thinking about how is my text organized? And we don't know yet. It's so confusing when it's read. But after 2 days of banging my head on it, I know it opens on the lack of perfection or completion within the Levitical priesthood. I know that it's closing on the lack of perfection or that which is complete in regard to the law itself. Observation number two. You also notice that the editors thought there was some kind of break in the logic, in the argument at verse 15. And yes, after 2 hours of reading that verses 11 through 14 over and over and over again, you thought there's the first movement of the argument. It's all dealing with this aspect of Levitical priesthood. That 11 to 14 is somehow related to this Levitical priesthood, whereas in 15 through really 19, it moves to something on the law itself, even quoting portions of the Old Testament. You've made a couple of other observations that this first one in the argument seems to be something about the descent of, right, or the line of this Aaronic priesthood is somehow incomplete. Whereas in the next one, what's the word in verse 15? It's not so much about simply the line being inadequate, but likeness. There's something here about likeness. That the likeness of Melchizedek now actually is comparatively moving. So you've done some work. You've begun to think by Tuesday, at the end of the day, that the argument the author is making to the audience is something concerning the spiritual superiority of the ministry of Jesus. First, in regard to what was inadequate within the priesthood. Second, in what is equivalent to his likeness concerning what the law had actually said would come. You're that far. And now it's, you took Wednesday off because you were shot, you know, no, not shot like in my neighborhood, but shot like in your neighborhood. We can talk about my neighborhood all you want. We got a lot of work to do there. But you're tired. You were tired. Something came up. I don't know. You had soccer practice. You're trying to reach your neighbors. You haven't mentioned the word Jesus yet, but you've known him for 3 months and had 18, you know, IPAs with him. They don't know you're a Christian yet, but, you know, you're working hard to kind of do the relational thing. At any rate, you didn't get to your sermon on Wednesday, but now you're coming back on Thursday and you're like, you know what? My mind has to start moving. My mind has to start moving because Sunday's coming. And I've spent about as much as I can do here. I see how it's organized generally, but I've got to start generating some movement this direction. Based solely on what you know, how might you begin thinking about an argument to your audience? Better yet, what tools do you need in your hand to begin to move from the argument of the text to the argument of your audience? Just experientially at your table, how do you do this? What helps you move from argument in the text to them and then to argument for today through my sermon? What tools are you using to make that journey? Just talk about it at your table for a minute. Because whatever those tools are, we all need, if they're good ones. By tools, I mean strategies. What strategies help you transition from the argument of the text to the argument of your talk? Okay, I'll give you another minute. Maybe a different guy at your table can say a thing or two. What strategies help you make the transition from the argument of the text to the argument of your talk? All right? Let's hear a few. You guys all write talks. What strategies are you using that will help you make the transition from the argument of the text to the argument of your talk? Somebody just call one out.
Answering the so what question.
All right. So what? That's a great strategy. I think it is a great strategy because if you're asking so what, you're now moving away from simply understanding what the text says to what this will then require of those who hear it. Yeah, so that's a decent strategy. At least mentally now you've moved. You've moved from historical, grammatical work, theological reflection work. Your mind is now moving to today. Somebody give me another one. All right, so the people itself. Yeah, we'll come back to that as well. Both of these, yep.
Yep. How they're like and unlike the original audience.
How they're like and unlike. Yeah, in fact, let's just do this now. I think one of the strategies for me is to just put my people in my mind. I've now moved to the point in the week where my people are supposed to be influencing my sermon. But you got to keep something clear. There are people in the text. You'll work on this in your small groups. There are people to whom your text was written. And then there are the people to whom you preach. And guess what, guys? They're not all the same. So in our text here, this little text for this week, we've got Aaron and we got Melchizedek. And we've got our Lord descended from Judah. Those are people in the text. Guess what? Those aren't the ones to whom you're preaching. You've also got the people to whom this was written, your historical context, which we'll deal with in a bit. And then you've got the people to whom you preach. But you really have to start thinking about how are my people, not so much we'll deal with this on audience later, not so much who are the representatives in my congregation of those that are in the text, but how are those in the text relating to my Lord, and how might that have implication for those of us in how we relate to the Lord? You need to start thinking a little differently. This whole character, enfolding characters in the story to people in your pews, that's kind of dangerous. I'm going to give you three tools. We've heard two from you. I'm going to give you three. And I've never done this before, so this, you're seeing this first. And it's, which is another way of saying, it's not good yet. But the tools of transition, right in that word is the word transit. I think this is what's required to present sermons that have a cogent argument. You need the tools of transit. So in Chicago, we have trains, right? So it's made me think about the red line, the blue line, the green line. But you got trains that are connected. You have cars. Cars take you from one place to the next. You need a train. You need a train that'll move you from text to today. Let me give you three or four cars that help. One is the structure of the text itself. The organization of the text helps me transition to the organization of my sermon. So there's some mirroring in your small groups this week between how someone answers their number one question, how is the thing organized, and then just kind of peek over at the guy's last question. Because there you see how it's organized, and then you see, but how did that influence his sermon? And sometimes you're like, wow, there's really good interaction there. Sometimes you're like, oh my gosh, there's a development there. I think he was like messed up on number one, but I don't know how he did it, but somehow by the time he got to that last question, he actually saw the organic structure of the text. And that's the way it works sometimes. But there should be some help to you in the structure and organization of the text that will help you begin to work on your presentation. Let me give you another car. It's already been mentioned here. The people in your congregation. And we'll deal with that particularly on the audience. But once your mind starts thinking about the people rather than the principles in the text, that is going to be a great help to you. I'll give you another one for me. One is repetition. Repetition, or you could call it iteration. I go through, iteration basically is the repetition of a process. And so if I'm looking back at our text in Hebrews 11, and on the author's argument, I see the imperfection of the Levitical priesthood in regard to the line, and I see the incompleteness of the law itself in regard to giving me someone of likeness. I look at that, and I, through a process of repetition, I write phrases over here for my sermon. Nobody in my congregation is thinking about Aaron got it done for me. So my first point can't be, you know, here we have the inadequacies of Aaron. My sermon outline, the inadequacies of Aaron. That's not helping my people. Nobody's looking for that. But I now am asking myself through the process of repetition, who or what offices, institutions, or individuals are my people looking to that would make them complete before God? And I come up with all kinds of different answers. None of them relate to an Old Testament Levitical priesthood. But all of them relate to, on what basis do, who is it, or in what work do you actually think you will end up standing before God? So you could actually get over here and you go, well, the line is my good works. That's an easy one. I'm my own line. Okay, my sermon might actually deal with that. And I'm writing different kinds of phrases. Likeness the same way. Let me give you another car, and then we're going to come back to it. One more car on the train. solitude, and silence. If you are not employing that tool in the writing of your sermon, I don't know how you end up making a cogent argument. Let me see if I can explain what I mean. Anybody read C.S. Lewis? Okay, so the guy who's an Englishman, you know, great writer in many respects, impossible to read in some other respects. I remember everyone telling me, you know, oh, you got to read, what was it? What was his real famous one? Mere Christianity. Oh my gosh, I was like 3 pages in. I couldn't understand a thing. But at any rate, he's a really good writer with his... I mean, the children stuff, right? That was like right at my level. Cookies on the bottom shelf. You know, wardrobe, Narnia, I'm in. He's got that one on the magician's nephew. Polly and these other... What happens is they go up to this attic and there's this like little pool, if you haven't read it. If you're a Mere Christianity guy, maybe you never read this one. But they jump in this pool with a ring or all this stuff and it transports them from an attic in London to a place called the Wood Between Two Worlds. And from there, they can get to a whole other world. And they come back and someone then they have to reveal to someone along the storyline of, you know, that they'd been to the Wood Between Two Worlds. And someone asks them, what's it like there? And I love Lewis's words. He goes, they're trying to describe it. And they're like, well, it's really quiet. And the air is heavy. And it's like molasses. And when I read that, I thought, that is my tool to be able to transition myself, to transport myself, to transit myself from the author's argument to my own world. Put it differently, it's this. It's Rodin's The Thinker. But how many of us really do that? We just go write it. We go, here's my historical grammatical stuff. Those are my, I see the outline, the organization there. So those are the, that's what I'm going to do over here. And we're doing sermons for today that are basically just content on text. We're doing instruction, but we're not doing persuasion. The Wood Between Two Worlds. I should probably get a drawing for that. I got to start working on that. You know, there they are up in the attic. You'll see this in a couple years in some book somewhere. The wood. Yeah, there you go. That's it right there. This is the essential tool. Quiet, silent, reflection that without which I can't actually get to coherent, clear principles. So for me, it happens by iteration, repetition. If I have my organization of the text on this side really clean, it might take me 5 iterations over a day and a half before I finally feel comfortable with the argument, even the headers that I'm going to be using. But if you don't do that time, you really miss out. So those are some tools. The structure will help you. Your people should help you. The keep working. Let me get the keep working thing a little better. My kids would write a paper for class. And then they would have me read it. And I would say, well, you think you're done? And they're like, yeah, I'm done. I'm like, this is like first draft. First draft. Guess what? Most of your sermons, they're first draft. And if you read those in my house for the 5th grader, I wouldn't let them go to school yet. I'd say, what's your thesis? Well, it's kind of, I think I kind of got it. We got guys going to the pulpit like that. Well, how does your thesis develop? What are the points that are actually proving what it is you're trying to persuade someone of? Well, I don't know, but I've got 3 different points. And I'm talking about the three, but there's no synthesis between them. There's been no real argument. We're talking about things in the text. We move from one thing to another about the text, but we're not actually synthesizing the text. And why? Because we don't do any of the repetition and the iteration. If you are going into the pulpit on first draft stuff, you are cheating your people on the persuasive potency of your preaching. So that's another reason you got to start early, right? Because if you, I kind of feel like my sermon's done on Thursday or Friday, done, ready. But man, that thing bakes. And Sunday morning, 5 to 8 in the morning, it's continuing to move those iterations to clarity, simplicity, brevity, plausibility. All those things begin to come. These are your tools. Let's go back, spend 4 minutes now thinking about the structure of the text. Let's just deal with structure since we don't have time for solitude. Think about your people. If you're a youth pastor here, a children's worker here, in all your small groups this week, your audience should be the people that you're going to be talking to. You're not talking to a bunch of senior pastors if that's not your audience. All your work should be governed around the people that you're talking to. They're the ones that matter. And so your people, think of maybe the organization that we've worked on, or think of quick-hitting repetition and iteration, and come back, and you've got 4 minutes as a table to come up with an argument on that. What is the one thing your table's out to persuade the listener of, and what are the points that prove it? Use this structure. Use your audience. All right. At some point, this is what your sermon outline looks like with this text. At some point, you will have a persuasive sentence. Notice the difference. It's not a sentence that says, "What's the big idea of this text?" It's a sentence that says, "What's the one thing I'm to persuade my people of from this text?"
I think if you get a broader...
Hold on a sec. Let me finish.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right. They gave me the mic. No, I know him. We're going to be okay. At some point, this sermon's going to have 2 points that prove it, whatever that is. And the first one is going to probably be the content of what I'm going to have to be preaching when I get to 11 to 14. But notice the second one. It's actually heightened in escalation, which most of our sermons, they'll say like 3 things, but there's no force or building nature to your sermon. Your sermons actually should be building to a climax. Look again at verse 15. This becomes even more evident when. Okay, see that? So he's laid something out, but now the argument turns in a way that's even more evident. And our sermons, rather than saying, "Well, I've got these 3 things to say today, and they all have equal weight," what you should work on in your small groups is, how is this sermon building as it moves from movement to movement within your text? And then, of course, you get down here and your congregation meets you at the back, and they're not like Festus who says, "Would you persuade me?" They say to you, "Pastor, I'm with you today. That conquered my life. That made a practical determination of my will. That brought me to obedience." Question or two or comment? He doesn't want in now. Come on, Tom.
No, I think if we're talking about lack of perfection, it's in the humanness.
Okay, you're going to the text itself. You're going into the Hebrews 7:11?
Yeah,
okay, go ahead. Well, I didn't really care to come up with an answer for Hebrews 7.
Well, I'm done.
Let me tell you why. My goal wasn't that we would all have a collective sermon from seven. My goal in this session is that utilizing that, we begin to think about the tools that I've got to employ to get the job done. And I think some of those tools you'll begin to work out in your small groups. But now we've got a question or two, and then we'll go take a break. Yep.